showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination.
Good morning, this is Paula Granquist, and you're listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thank you for listening to the show that celebrates creating and stories, and I am ready to tune our imaginations. I think this is going to be a great show, because I love a good story. If I could, I would live in the land of imagination and story every day. This past week, I went back and visited the library of my childhood, and that was such a great thing to do. I encourage everybody to do that, because it's, I don't know about you, but that was one of my magical places. And when I wandered into the picture book section, for a moment, I briefly hoped that one of my favorite books that I love to check out might be there in the bins. Of course, I knew it wouldn't be there, or it wouldn't be able to find it. It would have been years and years and years ago. But I thought about that book a lot. And all I remember, and this is why I'm never going to be able to track it down, is that it's a silly story, and there's one image in there with a boy and a goat, his messy room, and a funny grandmother, and a green umbrella. That is not much to go on, and I can remember working as a bookseller that's a really hard thing to be able to pull out, so I haven't even asked. Although I did find when I was Googling that there are, in fact, people who librarians and people who love kids' books, there are a couple websites you can post things, and a lot of times they do help you connect with favorite books from childhood. So that's kind of a fun little thing, maybe. But what I remember about it is it was also one of the thickest books in the section, and it had these beautiful inked illustrations. And it probably would have been one of the first books that I read that had different sections, like chapters. And I hope someday to reconnect that with that story. And someday I'll get back to that. But in the meantime, I'm going to keep enjoying lots of stories and my imagination, because it's one of the places that makes me the happiest. And every good story should have a surprise for the listener. That's what makes, I think, a good story. It's a twist that entertains, and there's something really satisfying about being a reader that's caught up in the story and then having the experience of being delighted or charmed or spooked or carried away. And we need stories in our lives. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I love doing Art Zany Radio, is because I love sharing these art stories with all of you. And today's story has a really good twist. I think it's really fun. I was made a connection with an author who also has a connection with Northfield. And I'll get to that story in a minute, but it's a really good one. So today the story comes to you. My guest today is author Dan Jorgensen, and he's going to discuss his new novel, Rainbow Rock, and share stories about his connections to Northfield. And his publisher is Speaking Volumes. You can get more information on that website. And he is, of course, a native Minnesotan, and he grew up in South Dakota. He attended a one-room country school and was the first member of his family to attend college, earning degrees in journalism and public relations from South Dakota State University, and he also did work on creative writing and film at Colorado State University. He's an U.S. Army infantry veteran, an honor graduate from the U.S. Defense Information School. He's had a very long career as a writer, editor, educator. He's won awards for all of these fields. He's the author of 8 books, 3 songs, and a one-act play, and has written many stories on the news, sports, and features, and on journalism and public, both as a journalist and in public relations. And this really intrigues me. He's a frequent presenter on the topics of storytelling, from journalism to creative writing, and the writing life. Dan and his wife currently live in Milliken, Colorado, and I'm going to welcome him to Art Zany Radio. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. Thanks. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Thank you for, we kind of made, it was a wonderful twist of fate that we made the connection. You happened to contact the radio station, and I had an opening for this week, and it all, it's like the stars lined up.
It was like stars aligned, no doubt about it. So, and I was looking at next, if it would have been next Friday, I wouldn't have been able to do it because I'm on my way to the Black Hills, where, which is the setting for my newest book, which, by the way, is book number 9.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I know. That's so the one, you've had 8, and now the one we're going to talk about, Rainbow Rock, is 9, right?
9, and it's just on the market for 1 week. So it's been great having it out. This is absolutely the first interview I've done about the book. So
oh, how exciting. It's so far, so we have a premiere here on the radio.
Yeah, that and $2.50 will buy you a cup of coffee, right?
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself. You have connections to Northfield, so there may be some of our listeners who recognize the name. Tell us a little bit about your world then and now.
Well, yeah, there have deep connections to Northfield. I came there in late 1983 to work for St. Olaf College in public relations, and my wife Susan and I lived there and raised our family there, and were there for 30 years before retiring in 2013 and moving out here to live in Colorado. Anyway, it's and we had all those years there of being involved with things with St. Olaf and being involved in the community. Both of us were very active in the Northfield Arts Guild Theater and musical theater, and as were our children. And our kids were active in sports, so we went and met a lot of people through that. And gosh, there's just, and I was in the Rotary Club too. So did a lot with the Rotary and the United Way there in Northfield. For a couple of years, I headed up the United Way drive. Very, very busy background in Northfield, and we loved every minute of it.
Oh, that, I thought there might be a connection. And tell me about some of the plays you were in, because I feel like that might have been where I remember connecting with you.
Well, could be. We started, I think, the very first big play that we did, the whole family who was involved in, was The Music Man. And we did it twice, actually. I was Charlie Cowell, the anvil salesman, and Susan, my wife, was the Eulalie McKechnie Shin character, the mayor's wife. And then the kids did kids' roles. And then a few years later, we did a bigger production of it under the direction of Kathy Rush out at the high school auditorium. And then that occasion, I played the mayor, and my wife reprised her role as the mayor's wife. So we had the connection of being married at home and being married on the stage.
Oh, that sounds
was
fun.
A big one. And over the years, I suppose between us, we've done 50 plays. You know, so
oh,
it's
wow.
been amazing.
That's no wonder the name is familiar. And you certainly have you continued doing plays? What, since you've moved out to Colorado?
We haven't. Here where we live in a little community, Milliken. It's not little, I guess. It's about 8,000 people. But we kind of have a connection between us and a neighboring town called Johnstown, which is similar to the Northfield-Dundas connection of being close together, you know,
mm-hmm.
and separate communities, but kind of a combined community. But believe it or not, they don't have a community theater. And between the two communities, there's over 20,000 people, but just like the Northfield-Dundas area. But maybe in the future, we'll have to wait and see. Right now, we would have to drive like up to Fort Collins or to Greeley or Loveland or a place like that. Those are the biggest communities near us. And we just haven't had the opportunity to get involved. But we attend theater yet. So
of course.
We do that.
What pulled you away from Northfield out to Colorado?
Well, my youngest daughter, Becky, and her family settled out here in like 2008, I think it was. She had a baby who was an extreme preemie and needed daycare at home for a while. And so we thought, well, we were about to retire anyway, we would move out here and be close to her and her family and help take care of the baby, you know, when he was home. And that's kind of what we did the first year we were out here. And then we sold our house in Northfield and continued to stay out here. We have our older daughter Carrie and her family, but they live out in Virginia, and their work, her and her husband do a lot of international traveling with Mercy Corps, and so they're on the road a lot and out living in other parts of the world. So we knew we wouldn't be living close to them, and so we wanted to be close to one of the families, and that's what brought us here in the first place. So
that makes sense. Yeah, well, it's great that you're coming back to us through Art Zany Radio, and you can share a little bit more of your story, because I'm sure there are lots of people that have had connections to you. And I would imagine you're someone who loves stories. I'm guessing with all the theater that you've done and the writing that you've done, public relations. Tell me why you love stories and what stories mean to you.
Well, you know, it's just like what you said when you were a child. You know, moving into the world of imagination, and that was true for me too. I mean, my mom always used to say when I was really little that she could always tell where, and then she called me Danny, where Danny is at, because I just look around to wherever the book is held up in the air, and he's behind it, and sitting there watching, reading, and you know. We didn't have television when I was a kid, and we had the radio, so we'd listen to stories on the radio, and then we would read books. And I started reading when I was like 4.5 or 5 years old, because it was such a great thing to do and move into a world that I couldn't be in myself. I was in this little community out in South Dakota growing up, and or on the farm a lot of the time, and that, to escape into another world, I mean, that was amazing. And that's just exactly what I found that reading did for me. It took me into whole new places. I dreamed and dreamed of going all these places and seeing some of these spots in the world, and books allowed that to happen. So
we
had
that in common, because that would have been my growing up too, just my nose in a book.
Oh, man. I tell you, and my it's kind of gone through the generations. I know I saw it with my own kids, and my oldest grandson now, he's the same way. My daughter said he must have inherited that from you, Dad, because he's always reading a book. he's got a great reader, and he's starting to do some writing at age 12. So, you know, I guess it's moving on through the generations.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, I would love to see that. And one of the things that intrigued me about your bio was that you've done some presentations on storytelling, and how I'd love to hear a little bit about that and what, you know, you've learned about the craft of creating story.
Yeah, as I started writing, I started out as a, when I went to college, I went to study journalism, and I really was interested in that. I'm surprised, I guess, at myself for not being more interested in creative writing at the time. But at the time, I really thought I wanted to be a newspaper person, and I was. And I got involved in writing, you know, news and feature stories. When I got out here, I came out to Colorado State University for a graduate program. And while I was there, I took a class in creative writing. And that really opened my eyes to that, as the telling of stories, you know, that are not necessarily based entirely on what's just happened in front of you in the world, but something that you can imagine in your mind and then put down on paper. And that's how I got started with that, the storytelling. And I come from a family background where telling stories at you know, in the evenings and stuff. Like I said, we didn't have television for a long time while I was a kid, and my dad used to, the night before we'd get ready to go to bed, he'd say, well, let's go sit down and I'll tell you a story, you know. And he'd tell stories about things out of the history of his family, or out of the things that he learned as a kid, or heard the fun adventure stories and things like that. And I always thought, boy, that's amazing to be able to do that. And we kids were just mesmerized by it. We'd sit around and listen to him at his feet, you know, and it really did help us. Sometimes it helped us get to bed. Other nights we were left so thrilled by the story that we couldn't get to sleep, you know.
Oh.
But that's kind of how the genesis of that came about. And I put the two together, you know, that background I had as a young boy and growing up, and then with that creative writing class that I took, really re-sparked my interest in that. And I actually wrote my first book in that class, and then continued to go with it from there as a side thing, more or less, because I had my full-time career going, first in journalism and then in public relations for education. And especially when I got to St. Olaf, I mean, there's plenty to do at St. Olaf without sitting there writing books for myself. But that's how I got going.
Well, I can imagine. I've found in the years over I've done those interviews that a lot of people who have a background in journalism are, you know, make great authors of fiction books. And I think, and you can tell me what you think about this, that a lot of that has to do with the discipline of writing every day, writing on deadline, you know, the idea that you have to keep producing. That you don't get stuck. You always are able to come up with something because you're used to that production of words on the page. Did that follow true for you?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And you know, you're always writing on deadline. In journalism, you don't have any option. You go out, you cover the story, you come back. It's got to be. People don't want to hear the story tomorrow or a week from now. They want to hear it now, and so you've got to get it ready. But so I learned to write fast in that regard and, you know, get the facts in there. But the same thing pretty much does hold true for creative writing because, you know, the publisher, they want a book from you. They've signed you to do a book and they want you to get a book to them. And you can't just say, oh, well, gee, today I think, or this week I think I'll take a few days off and not do anything. That doesn't work. And you know, you're only pretty much in creative writing as good as the next thing you produce, because as soon as you get something done, and the most heard words by an author are, gosh, what are you going to do next?
I know. I try never to ask that question unless I know they're working on something.
But I do. Going, I can talk to you about that later here.
Well, because it feels like, you know, you invest probably years in order to get each book to the, you know, finished product where you can talk about it and it's available for sale. And, you know, to think about, well, what, you know, or if you read it, somebody reads it and they're like, you know, that took me a few days and now I want you to have another one.
Well, that's right. I had actually the very first review that came onto Amazon from this person said I couldn't put it down, and I thought, well, that's great. And then I actually I'd leave my email out there for people that they want to send me notes or whatever. And this guy sent me a note and he said, I wasn't just saying that in print. I couldn't put it down. He said, and I read straight through for like 12 hours.
Wow.
And I went, whoa, well, that's encouraging, you know, that you liked it that much. So it's great. But, you know, that's right. Then he's done and he said, those dreaded words came up. So what do you got next?
Well, you've got a fan, and that's the way to look at it. And folks, if you're just tuning in, this is Paula Grandquist. I'm here on Art Zany Radio with Dan Jorgensen. We are going to talk about his new novel, Rainbow Rock, which is the ninth novel of his. This is my first novel that I've read of yours, and I'd love to hear the story of the origins of this book. There's Rainbow Rock, I think, is a real place, although the name you've given it is what characters called it.
Yeah, it is for people who my last two books have been set in the Black Hills, and The Wind Whispered came out in 2015. And that was a historical fiction novel set in the southern Black Hills. And then Rainbow Rock sort of grew out of that in a way. It's in the same general area. And there's a place that locals know along a place called Spring Creek that they call Rainbow Rock because you go up on there and you look down on the creek. And in certain times of the day, when the sun comes through the mist, it forms little rainbows along the creek. And so that's they call it Rainbow Rock because not because the rock looks like a rainbow or there's any rainbow coming out of it, but because you can see the rainbows from there. But the other thing about the Rainbow Rock is South Dakota's state gemstone is the Fairburn Agate. And the Fairburn Agate is in an area there in the southern Black Hills, the only place you can really find it in the Black Hills area or in the state, as far as that goes. And it's a rainbow colored rock. There's bands of bright colors all through it. Agates normally are that way anyway, but the Fairburn agate has distinctive colors, and people, locals, and especially the Native Americans, call it the Rainbow Rock. And so that plays a big role in this book. This area where you can find the Fairburn agate is a pretty rugged area where people could hide out, or there'd be chase scenes or things like that. And I always thought about that would be a good location to stage some of what I would write if I was going to ever write this book. And so the Rainbow Rock has a dual meaning in this case. It's a rock and it's a place.
Yeah, I have to say, I used to go collecting agates with my dad all the time. We used to go out by the gravel yards, and we would, you know, have Saturday mornings go poking around. And I think as a kid, I didn't quite appreciate it as much as I do now looking back. But, you know, we found some spectacular agates. And in your book at the end, there's a picture of what this type of agate. I have never seen anything like this. It is so spectacular. It just really got me excited about, you know, what it looks like, and to discover that it's something that really only is from that place.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and it's the Fairburn agate fields. You know, people come from all over the world really to search for the agates, and finding them is pretty rare. Like only one in about 800 people find one when they're out there.
Wow!
But just walking through the area is worth the trip in itself, as far as that goes. So, but they are spectacular. They're really amazing, and I had some consultation with some native friends who are from that area, and you know, one of them had a Fairburn agate, and he was showing it to me, and how they look upon it as a protector stone. If you have one, it protects you from all kinds of maladies, everything from illnesses to danger from people trying to hurt you or whatever. And so when I saw it, I thought, huh, this has got to be part of my book somehow or other.
Yeah, that's really spectacular. And so just even learning just that little bit was exciting for me. And this story is clear that you have a connection to this land, because I think it comes through in the writing that you love this place, that you know this place, that you can write with great detail, and, you know, makes it come to life for us. And so I guess that makes sense then that other of your books have been set in there. And but the thing that I found really interesting is that this is set in the 1950s. I don't know if the other books are. And I kept finding myself just being amazed at you know, how far the technologies have come. And so that, you know, going back to that mindset of being in the 1950s and like, oh, yeah, you can't just make a call or look it up on a, you know, map in your car, or, you know, that there's a lot of things that don't get solved because, you know, the assistance that we have now with technology is just amazing. So how did it feel to go back into that mindset of the 1950s and kind of get those details right?
Well, it was an interesting process, I'll tell you. I did grow up, I was a kid in the 1950s, so I had that background. But the other thing was just to think about, you know, you find yourself always wanting to grab a cell phone, as you say, and you can't do that. You have to say, okay, where would the next phone booth have been?
Yes.
Or where could my one protagonist is a marshal who I named Al Tucro. Where would Al Tucro go to get a phone to call in and make sure that something happened? Well, he'd have to go locate it because he couldn't do it. He might be able to call on his radio from his police car, but otherwise he's got to get to a place where he can physically pick up a phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was interesting. And then I started looking too back to what would they have been eating, or how would you take out a cup of coffee? They didn't have, you know, coffee cup to go cups really. You'd have to, you know, in one scene, guy goes in to get some coffee to take out. Well, he carries his own thermos with him because that's what they had to do. He had to do that. You couldn't just pick up a cup of coffee and take it out. That you would take their cup if you did that, and that would not be possible. So those kinds of little things, and I found some advertising things like for 7-Up and Coca-Cola and stuff. Mm-hmm. And would they have been on the walls in a cafe? Yes, probably. And so, you know, what would they say, and how would the characters react to seeing those? And those are the kinds of things that I had to think about and put together. So you talked about the how long it takes. You know, it takes me about 5 years to write a book. Mm-hmm. I'm a slow writer. At the pace I'm going, I'm hoping I get a couple more before my life is over. But that, you know, it's about a 5-year process for me. I tell people when I'm out speaking that, yeah, every 5 years, like it or not, I come up with another book, you know. But
well, but you can tell when I'm reading it that you've done that work to authenticate some of those things and solve some of those problems. We should tell our listeners a little bit about the story, because the story begins with a friend receiving a call about another friend who is in big trouble. And yeah. That it pulls you in right away. As soon as you open the book, there's a great opening scene. And this is, so they have to drive, it's about half an hour away. And I love, there's a phone booth in that opening scene. And it just made me sort of giggle, right? To think about, you know, phone booths and how, you know, hard it would be if you're in trouble to try and nobody can track you. Nobody can, you know, you can't stay on the line while you're running. You have,
yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
And
you can't hide someplace and talk, whisper into your cell phone, you know, you need to come and get me right now because I'm in deep trouble here. He had to say that and then get into hiding after saying it because he was in deep trouble, and that's kind of the premise of the story, and the rest of the story is built around the people that this young man is calling for help, trying to figure out what actually happened to him. And, you know, we, the readers, know right away what happened to this guy, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
His friends and the lawman and this reporter I created, Maria Tager, she and the marshal and his best friend don't know what happened to him, and they're trying to find out. And that's and we follow the process with them as they go through the story to determine what happened to their friend. And the friend is named Jean Darvaux, and Jean is killed at the beginning. Now, I'm not spoiling anything here,
right,
because you know that in the first two pages.
That's right. Go ahead.
Well, anyway, so then they know that, or I mean, they know he's dead. They just don't know how he's dead. We do. We, the readers, know how he died, and we learn that in the first chapter, or the first two chapters. And then after that, it's up to them to catch up with us, the readers. And so we're following along with them. Well, what if we were this character? How would we react? And that's how I kind of built the story around their reactions and how we would be walking the walk with them as they went to search for these answers.
Yeah, it's a very fast-paced story, and I mean, you alternate chapters with the you know, the law enforcement story, the friends of Jean, his friend Frank, and then Jean's sister. Slipped.
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, yeah. And, you know, how they're trying to put the pieces together. And one of the intriguing things was both of these boys, I guess they're older boys, but they're, you know, maybe, what, 18, 20, somewhere in there?
Yeah. Right. They're both. One's 18 and one's 19. Yeah,
they're right. And they're both Native Americans in the South Dakota area. And so one of the issues is that, you know, Gene dies. Frank discovers him, but he can't really go to the police because they'll probably set him up for the fall. And I thought that was a really interesting detail of, you know, the position that he's put in because of that.
You know, when we were growing up on our farm in South Dakota, my family had a Native American family friend who always would say things like that. You know, I have to be really careful when we do things, because I'm susceptible to being charged with doing that, even if I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I took from that. And then when I worked as a reporter out in the Black Hills, first at the Hot Spring Star and then at the Rapid City Journal, I heard that many times from Native people. We have to be so careful because we may or may not be guilty, but we're definitely going to be considered guilty until proven innocent. It's not the other way around. So that's kind of where I built that out of. And Frank, Gene's friend, feels he's in that situation all the time. And Gene's sister, Elizabeth, says the same thing. You've got to be really careful because if you go in there and start reporting these things that you know, they're going to say, how do you know that? You know, you must be guilty. You must be the one that had something to do with it. So that's how I built that.
Yeah, and I think what reading it and knowing that it was set in the 1950s, it made me really sad that not a lot has changed, you know, between that's years, 70 years ago. And that's just really disheartening. But, it's the truth, right? So
true. And I said it in the 50s. Also because it was a time when there was some drug trafficking problems going on in the Black Hills, and I had learned about that when I was a reporter as well. So those were things that I created this file folder sort of ideas for writing creatively, and if I ever got back to it, and one of them was, don't forget about the drug issues that were going on. And maybe that can be tied into a story, and it was during the 1950s, so there was a big methamphetamine problem at that point, and it all had kind of grown out of World War II and the Korean War. A lot of people don't know this, but during World War II and the Korean War, there was a use of methamphetamine that was kind of casual by. Even the government thought, this will keep our troops alert if we give them these things. And, well, after they got out, they kept the habit, you know, which is a bad deal. So
yeah,
that's where that.
I found that to be another very fascinating element of the book, because I hadn't, you know, made the connection that had originated. And at first, when I was reading it, I thought, well, that must just be something he made up. But then at the end, you have in the appendix, you have the details about how that really was a true element of
I tell people to be sure to read the afterword in both And the Wind Whispered and in Rainbow Rock, because there's I'd say what's fact and what's fiction. And that's where I put those together. So, that's an interesting thing I had found out too, and I didn't know that either until I started to research this book.
That is a really an incredible story element, because you can imagine how that could corrupt people who want to continue, you know, expanding their market and, you know, continue to keep making their money off of this and finding new audiences, if you will, for this highly addictive drug that it's just unfathomable that somebody would think, this is a good idea. Let's keep giving it to people.
Yeah, this is a good idea. Not a good idea.
No, and so that's another tension within the story, is that you have this drug trade going on, and you have, so you're trying to figure out, you know, the audience, the readers know a little bit, but the people in the story are trying to figure out, you know, what's the real story, who's the good guy, you know, how are we going to solve who killed Gene? And I'm curious, as far as structuring the novel, how long did it take to figure out how to, you know, tell those stories and interweave those pieces so that it, you know, flowed so easily for the reader as we just raced through what was happening?
Well, it took a couple of years, actually. I had the point that I use of starting for the novel, but it's actually going to be probably chapter 7 or 8. You know, I was gonna lead into it more, and then one of the beauties of modern technology, of course, is being able to move big blocks of type around on your, you know, just highlight something, copy and paste it. And I started thinking maybe maybe this needs to be to the front, and then go back and tell how it got to that point. And that's what ultimately I ended up with. But it took me probably between 2 and 3 years before I had all the elements that I wanted. I who my characters were going to be. My Maria Tager character, who I think is a major character, she's a young reporter who is working out there, who had moved out from the East Coast.
She's a dynamo.
Yeah. And she was a guy to start with in my first draft of this. And I thought, no, it doesn't work with this reporter being a guy. I need to have to, in order to create some of the tension that I need, it needs to be a woman, and it needs to be a young woman, and she needs to have some kind of connection, especially to the old marshal, Al Tucro. That was another thing. I said, okay, how am I going to develop that? And so I keep going back to my other book, but And the Wind Whispered has Al Tucro, and it has Maria's great aunt and her grandmother as young people at the same age that Maria is now. And so there's that connection back and forth between young women who were my age 50 years ago and now this old marshal who was my grandmother's and aunt's friend as a teenager, and then trying to tie them all together in the modern day, which in the modern day in this book is 1955. So,
yeah, I think
I kind of randomly selected 55 because I really wanted to say something about the song "Rock Around the Clock," and it was just out hitting the airwaves, and there was this big radio station we all used to listen to when I was a teenager, called KOMA out of Oklahoma City. It was called Coma, and all the hits from Coma, and they really got their start around 1955 doing rock and roll music that teenagers would listen to, and so I thought, okay, I want to get Coma in there, and I want to get Rock Around the Clock and all that, so it gave me a chance to do that.
And it made it in.
It's good.
Yeah, and all those details are, so that's interesting that then you have characters that sort of, is this a series to you? Do you think the interrelated books are?
I think, yeah. I originally didn't think that, but now I think so. The publisher, when they released Rainbow Rock, the last sentence they sent to me as they say, you know, congratulations, and by the way, we think that Al Tucro is an ongoing character, and you ought to find other ways to use him in books, like Al Tucro, Lakota Lawman. He's a deputy marshal,
mm-hmm.
and I like that idea. And my next book is going to be set in the 1920s, 1927, to be precise, because it's being set in the area where they're just starting to get ready to carve Mount Rushmore, and so I can make Al Tucro a nice 35-year-old deputy marshal at that point, or 40-year-old deputy marshal, because I've already established that he is that in this book. So, and I've got earlier establishment of him in as a young man in The Wind Whispered. So, you know, might as well.
that's very exciting because, you know, it's clear that you enjoy this place, that you are reflecting that, and you've done your homework, right, to be able to make this, you know, feel real and alive and just what a reader wants, right? Just enough detail and a little bit of history. And so we learn something, and the characters are really intriguing. You've got great backstories. I was thinking about when you're writing about some of these characters, both, you know, Gene and Frank, and then Marshal Tucro. Did you mentioned in the afterword that you had some help with helping to create those characters authentically? Tell me about that's really important.
Well, we actually, my wife and I were really good friends in Hot Springs with Albert Tucro. This young, the character is named Alvin Tucro, but it's Tucro is someone we knew well, and we learned a lot of things from him. But I knew a lot of other Native American leaders and people who who were not only elders, but just ordinary people who we would interact with on a daily basis. Because there's a really major Lakota reservation there, the Pine Ridge Reservation, right there. Mm-hmm. And so I would, as a reporter, I was going out there often to do stories and things, and I would like go to the trading post on the edge of the reservation, or I'd be out walking, getting a ride with a native ranger to go out and explore something that I needed to write about. And they'd always be telling me stories, and we were talking about terms that you could use, different Lakota words and stuff for things. And so that's where that all grew out of. And then I met this woman who I was going to write a feature story about. And she said, you know, we've been in Hot Springs for a long time, since the mid-50s, when my brother was murdered. And I went, your brother was murdered? And she said, yeah, he was kind of caught up in the drug trade. And that's the first time I'd heard a little bit about that. And he wasn't involved personally, but he got murdered because of it. And they never found his killers. And so she said, and then she told me a little bit more about that. And but I was writing the story about her for some other thing, you know. And so then I moved away, and we moved to Northfield and lived. And and when I went back there, she was no longer there. And I never did find out where she moved to, or if she died or whatever. But that's where I first kind of heard the story about the young man being killed in the drug trade, who was Native American, and it was his sister who was living in Hot Springs. And so I had that connection right there. But there were many other, my wife and I at one point took a group of, this is, you talk about being masochistic, we took 13-year-old Native American girls to a Native American youth leadership conference, and we drove from the Black Hills all the way down to Tucson, Arizona, with 13-year-olds, and I tell you, that was an experience.
I get just any group of teenage girls, wow.
Yeah, but these were all from three different reservations, and a lot of them were just meeting each other for the first time, and then first big long trip, and they were going to do all these things, and we had two minivans, and we were driving them in, and oh my goodness, it was quite an experience. A three-day trip each way, and plus being on the location, and we got tons of stories from them. We still stay in touch with some of those girls. They're now, you know, they're now grandmothers themselves. Some of them are. So that was another tie-in that we had. So anyway, that's how we made the Native American connection, and got a lot of the things that I was able to use in this book.
Yeah, oh, that's, I love the way that you've taken those little bits that, you know, and you've kept the file folder. I think that's a really important thing if you want to write, to sort of plant those little seeds and, you know, imagine what stories might grow. And they take time to grow.
And they do.
And they take time to sort of make those connections. And tell me about creating the characters' backstories, because I found them all really well-developed, and, you know, kind of each of them has their troubles and their, you know, ways of being that are distinct. You've done a really great job.
Well, thank you. It's kind of, again, built, and I advise anybody interested in doing writing like this to start to think about that. Your character isn't just in the moment. You've got to think about, where did this character come from, and how did she or he get to this point that you've got them in your book? And then, so I always sit down with a couple of pages, blank pages, with each of my characters, and then I just start to say, okay, what would this character have been doing maybe, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 5 years, whatever. And then, you know, how would they have gotten to this point? And then jot those things down. And I still am old-fashioned in that I keep those kinds of notes in longhand, you know, and I write them down. And once I have built what I feel is a plausible character, then I can start to put that character, plug that character into my story. And it's been interesting, like with Two Crow, he's 79 years old in this book, but I had him in the first book that I wrote. He was 19. And in that book, I had already created kind of a backstory for him. And now I've had to decide what happened to him between the age of 19 and now. And what would he have done at various points, and then bring those into the story. So, and for Maria, you know, I'm not a 20-year-old reporter. And I've got to figure out what would a young woman, and a part of that for me is good. I was a girls sports coach for many years. I coached basketball and soccer, you know, not soccer really. I helped a little bit with that, but I coached basketball, girls basketball, for many years. And the girls would always tell me stories about their background and stuff. And, you know, you go on these long bus rides to games and stuff, and you get everybody's story. And everybody's story kind of became background information for Maria's story. So, or for any young woman in my books. I've got three key young women in And the Wind Whispered, and same thing for them. So, you know, you assimilate things if you're a writer, and you put it on that shelf. You know, I say I've got a big dusty shelf in my brain. it's got all these little books of things on them, and every once in a while I can go into the dusty shelf and pull the book out and look at it again and say, okay, I remember now. And it's getting harder to do that as I get older, but it's still there.
Well, we're lucky that you're able to do that, because it's a really great story, and it's full of all kinds of great details and characters. And so this one is about Jean's murder and figuring out who, you know, how they can find out what happened to their friend. I guess you should tell us a little bit about the plot in The Wind Whispered, because we mentioned that a couple of times, and people might also want to pick up that book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I think it's been it's in a new edition too right now, a brand new edition, and a little larger, what they call a quality book paperback format now, and beautiful new cover. I really love it. Anyway, The Wind Whispered is set in 1894, and that grew out of the fact that I was working in Hot Springs, and I often heard about things that happened when people would come there. It was a spa resort sort of community, and people from back east or even different parts of the west would congregate there for the healing waters and relaxation and getting together. And right about the early 1890s, there was also this kind of a vicious outlaw gang operating out of the area, and called the Curly Gang, and they were causing problems for everybody and holding up trains. And a lot of these people would come into the community via train in those days, and so I thought, well, there's a connection there between those and maybe a train robbery that could be built into a larger story.
Oh, sure.
And then Wind Cave is right north of Hot Springs, and it's a gigantic national park cave, one of the largest underground caves next to Mammoth Cave in the country. And I thought, well, what if they found somebody murdered in that cave? And so I created the opportunity for these two young sisters, young meaning in their late teens, who are interested in journalism and being reporters, and their friend Al Tucro finding this body in the cave. And that's how that story starts. And they go back and try to figure out what's going on with this person and how this person ended up dead in Wind Cave. And the title And the Wind Whispered comes out of the fact that the Native Americans have a belief that their universe was created by the Great Spirit moving under the sacred Black Hills and emerging out of Wind Cave. The wind goes out of Wind Cave in the morning because of atmospheric pressure, and it goes back in at night as the pressure changes. So the wind whispers sort of as it moves out and in. And one of my Native American friends always said, yes, and the wind whispers when it goes in and out of Wind Cave. And I went, oh, a good title for a book. I have, among my famous characters, I have Nellie Bly, the great reporter out of.
I love Nellie Bly. Go ahead and tell the story, but my, that's a she's an amazing character from history.
Well, and that was her title, you know, the amazing Nellie Bly, and she did actually come there, and while she was there, she met the guy that would become her husband. They met on the train, and that's part of my story,
and that's Wild a true Bill, detail.
Buffalo Bill Hickok and Annie Oakley, they were there, and I bring in a young Will Rogers, who's only 16 at the time, and also William Allen White, the very famous reporter journalist out of Kansas, and he helps. All these people come together in Hot Springs and help solve who killed this guy in the cave, and also help put a stop to this outlaw gang that's terrorizing the community. So that's that story. Seth Bullock is there. Theodore Roosevelt's in the book.
Oh, wow. You really have brought history to life.
It's a who's who in the Old West. But it got great reviews. And it's called the Reader's Favorite Reviewer Service. They said bringing these characters together in this way was really a novel, sorry for the pun on the word, but novel idea and works really well. So I was glad for that. So, yeah. That's how that first book came about.
That's fascinating, and that's a great plug for that book, too. Folks, this is Paula Granquist, and we're here on Art Zany Radio.
A lot of people there in Northfield would know about that, and I did come back there at the time that book first came out, and we did some book signings, and I made a presentation to the Rotary and stuff like that. So, I'd like to end with this book. So,
yeah, I was going to ask that question. Do you think you'll be returning back to Northfield?
I think so. You know, and it'll probably be later in the year, but I definitely would like to come and spend a few days and maybe do something. You know, and maybe with Content Bookstore and then do something maybe up at St. Olaf and with the Rotary. I'm a Rotarian for years and years, so
right. Yeah, that would be fantastic. You'll have to keep us posted, and I'll be sure to let folks know that you might be coming. So we'll look for that. That would give chance for people to read Rainbow Rock. And I think you can read them, you know, I hadn't read the prior one and felt very comfortable just as, you know, getting into the lives of these characters.
They stand alone. The books stand alone. You don't have to read one first or the other first. They each have their own story, and while there may be some couple of characters that are in both books, they each are individually set books. So yeah, they're good. And you can get the books. I mean, you could order. I know you can get Rainbow Rock through Content, and The Wind Whispered is out. They're both out nationally on all the different platforms, and especially ebook platforms for people who like to read on ebooks. Print versions, you know, places like the bookstores and Barnes and Noble and places like that have them. I think Content might not be able to order And the Wind Whispered regularly. I mean, they might. I shouldn't say they can't, but they. It's an Amazon printed book this time, so the new version. But the other one, Rainbow Rock, is. They're both by the same publisher, so I don't understand all that, the ins and outs of that. But anyway, Rainbow Rock is definitely available everywhere, and you could pick it up there or online or any way that you feel comfortable doing that.
That's exciting to be able to have that out and to be able to talk about it. And if you come back to Northfield, what are some of the places you're going to want to visit or the places that you miss or want to check in on?
Well, we miss both colleges, of course. They're wonderful, and we used to have a big connection. Still do. I mean, we were so sorry when the hotel burned down because we were always friends with people that ran the place and did things there, and so that was sad. The Ole store, and we had lots of friends in living in Northfield yet, and Dundas and that whole area. So we certainly want to see all those people again. My daughter, youngest daughter, the one that lives out here in Colorado, she's a graduate of Carleton. So I was, my wife and I were working at St. Olaf, and she went to Carleton. So that was, why not, right?
Well, that's lucky, because I always worry that I'd love for my kids to go to either St. Olaf or Carleton. But I think because we live here, sometimes I wonder if they just venture out into the world.
Well, that's what we were saying, too. And the youngest one said, when she was starting to look at colleges, you know, I'm looking everywhere, you know, we will throw around. And then somebody said to her, well, you ought to at least check out the local schools. So she kind of looked. She didn't need to stay at St. Olaf. She knew we'd been up there with us many times. But she said, well, I'll go stay at Carleton and see what I think. And she was there for a couple of nights, and she came home and said, I'm going to Carleton.
Well, I hope you keep your connections to Northfield, and do come visit us and let us know so we can all get together and talk about Rainbow Rock and maybe the next one that you're writing. You said it's going to be set in the 20s. That'll be a really intriguing time as well to explore. So thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Paul. I really appreciated it, and I'm glad you've been reading it, so, and I'm glad you liked it. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It is a page-turner, and that's a great thing. You want, as a reader, you want to be drawn into the story and wondering what's going to happen and living through these characters, and you've done a great job doing that. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, greet everyone for me, and hi to Jeff.
Absolutely. Dan Jorgensen, folks, and again, the new book is Rainbow Rock. I've got a link to the publisher's website on kymnradio.net in our posting for today's interview. Speaking Volumes is the publisher, and you can check out that as well to find out more details or information about ordering, as he mentioned, any different version, or check your local bookstore. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Folks, I appreciate you tuning in to Art Zany Radio and for being a part of the show. And I want to give you a quick reminder that this is the last weekend at the Paradise Center for the Arts for the La Cage aux Folles, which I did an interview a couple weeks ago. So that is a show happening. You want to get your tickets for that. Also, I'm reminded from our friend Richard Coleman that the Noontime Organ Concerts start in July. There are, I believe he said, 7 of them. And I think it's July 20th. He wanted to point out he's going to be performing out at the glorious Valley Grove Church on a restored 1910 pipe organ. So hope you'll put that on your calendar and check out lots of the things happening. Make sure you take advantage of the beautiful summer in Minnesota. This is Art Zany Radio. Please remember to add some Art Zany to your life. And of course, in the meantime, until next time, enjoy your imagination.
You've been listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zany is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region. Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372.
It's time to bring back the fun.